Accession number 31554, Reel 3.
Harry Leach, Reel 2. You were telling me about why the unit stayed longer than would normally be expected.
The function of an airborne division or brigade is normally to land from the air by glider or parachute, which was my way of going. I was a para, and capture and hold a particular objective, which in the case of 6th Airborne Division was the two bridges over the Canal du Con, which is now called Pegasus Bridge, and over the River Orne, which we captured immediately. The story of the capture of Pegasus Bridge has been told many times. You have that, haven't you, the gliders?
Oh yes, been there several times.
And also a bridge over the River Dive, and at, I believe it was at Trelawn. The function of the division or the airborne was then to hold these until relieved. And normally we should have gone back to England for refitting, assimilating reinforcements for those who've been killed or wounded, and prepared for the next operation. The way things went in Normandy, we were just left holding the two bridges, which we did. The Germans never got back there, and our battalions fought them off, many attacks, and we were kept in Normandy and eventually came home in, as far as I can remember, late August.
So you were very tired by then, I should think.
I don't remember. I don't think so. We were fit. We were young and fit. And this was the job we had to do. And we got on with it and did it.
So how did you get out? Did you go from a boat from the Aramont, from
yes,
Marlby Harbour?
Yes, we had reached, our forward battalions had reached the River Seine. And then we were all told, right, turn around, back. And we drove back. And as far as I can remember, we went direct, straight down to Aramont. And I remember clearly walking out along the pontoons onto whatever ship it was we came home, probably a landing craft tank, and then straight from there back to our camp. We always operated from the same billets in Bulford Camp on Salisbury Plain, which was a trifle upsetting, really. And you came back into your barrack room and you naturally went straight to your bed space, and then there was Pat's bed empty, Ken Thompson's bed empty, and others empty who had been wounded. But the reinforcements were brought in and very quickly settled down, and we settled down to training them, because when a wireless operator in particular, that job, is trained at the training battalion, he's only, shall we say, perhaps a third trained. There's a big difference between being trained to operate a wireless set, which you can do then, and actually working it in action. The wireless sets we used at the time, they were nominally, there was the 22 set, as it was then, which was rated at about 10-12 miles range, and the 68 set, which was rated as about 5 or 6 miles range. And then these were superseded by slightly better. We normally used to work them for 20 miles or 30 miles, no problem. But it takes a lot of experience to be able to do that. And we worked them over some pretty long ranges in Malaya and Java when we later on after the war.
So when you went back to Balfour Camp, was there a sort of mixture of relief to be out of it, but sort of upset to be leaving everybody behind who was still fighting?
No. Great relief that we are back home, we're in one piece, and there are others of our lads who... We were very lucky. We only had three killed in Normandy. Lieutenant Royal, who was the second in command, and Ken Thompson and Pat Leatherbarrow, who were very good lads. I visit their graves every time I go out. And
where are they buried?
They are buried in Romville, in our own airborne cemetery in Romville Churchyard. Have you been there?
No, but I think I'll be going next time I go over.
Yes. My family went over with a school party years ago, and my daughter was saying, oh, you know, the massive cemeteries, which are very impressive. And I said to her, I said, well, Joan, our little cemetery in Romville Churchyard, there's only a few hundred there, but they are all our lads. And three of them I knew and loved personally.
So once you got back to Balfour, training continued, because obviously you thought you may possibly be needed again for further operations.
The first thing that happened, of course, is with the airborne, when we return from an operation, you have what is called a form G1098. This is a form listing every single item of equipment that is issued to you. All our G1098 equipment after an operation was handed in, and that went away to stores or somewhere to be sorted out and disposed of or refurbished or whatever. And then we were completely re-equipped with new. That was the first thing. And then home leave, back home. And
I bet your mum was pleased to see you, wasn't she?
Well, of course, she knew I was alive because, you know, I used to write frequent letters, and they didn't take all that long to get home, considering conditions. It's not a bad service. Better than the present day post office, I think.
So after your leave, you back to Balfour, was it?
Back to Balfour, and we continued training because obviously, particularly the battalions, they had the new lads, reinforcements, who were trained paras, okay, but they needed a lot of training to assimilate them into the sections, platoons, wherever they were going, and they were very good lads. Although I say it myself as a para, there was some very fine men in the airborne, and that goes for the American airborne. They were terrific lads. And the one German parachutist that I knew and was very friendly with after the war.
So did you have any contact in England with like the 82nd or 101st American Airborne? Did you have company, you know, American football matches or anything like that, rounders?
Not a great deal. There was quite a few fellows went on exchange visits to the American Airborne. I never went on one of those, but we always had a very high regard for the American Airborne. And sadly, there used to be occasional fights between American troops and British troops in England. And if there was a fight going on and some English Airborne came up and found that there was American Airborne and British soldiers fighting, not airborne. Our blokes were piling
with the Americans.
On the American side.
Esprit de corps.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
I had a chap I knew I was with a short while in the American Airborne, and I'll never forget one day we were walking through not Salisbury, a small town down near there, and there was an American soldier, a black American soldier, walking the other way with his arm round an English white girl, and I had quite a job to restrain this American. I said, you can't. He said, God damn it. He said, he lived in the right in the south of America, where 1944, it was still very much
segregation.
He said, God damn it. He said, if I saw that at home, he said, I'd shoot him. I said, you what? He said, yes. So just shoot the devil. That's what he said.
I'm sure that's quite true, actually.
Yeah.
Yes. So, summer went on. You came back in August. And
yes.
Were you involved with the Arnhem?
No.
In any way, no?
We were at home on leave when Arnhem, and being in the signals, I knew there was a slight possibility we might be recalled to go there, because we were actually on leave. And this never happened, because obviously things went the way they did, and they should never have gone there. But still, that's a sad story. I've been back to Arnhem. I had a very, very close friendship with a Dutch family who I met in Java after the war, and they'd just been released from Japanese hands, and they'd all survived. And I was staying with them in Holland in 1948, and we were having breakfast, and father, my Dutch father, sadly all dead now, he said to me, he said, you must go to Arnhem tomorrow. It's the first pilgrimage of 1st Airborne Division. So I went back with Maritje and Doris, the two of their four daughters. And as I said to them, if there's one chap that I knew who was in our section, was a Canadian called Dan Higley. And he was at Arnhem, and then he was with us out in the Far East. And the bus pulled up in the centre of Arnhem at a lamppost, and leaning on the lamppost was an airborne sergeant in the Royal Signals called Dan Higley, who just looked at me, and his Canadian expression was, horseshit, goddammit, what are you doing here? And I spent the whole day with him in and around Arnhem at the celebration dinner. I had a wonderful time. Because he said, you know, you're airborne. So, later on in the afternoon that day, we were around in Arnhem, and an English couple came up to Dan, and they said, your Royal Signals, and Dan said, yes. He said, do you by any chance know our son, a signalman, I don't know his name, his surname, and I knew Dan very well, and I saw his face, so I quietly slipped away a little. And after this couple had gone, I said to Dan, I said, now what was that? I said, why did they pick on me? He said, I helped this boy across the Rhine because he couldn't swim. We had to swim for it. And we got out on the other bank of the Rhine safely, climbed up the bank, and we're just going over the top of the bank to safety, and he dropped dead with a bullet, a stray bullet from somewhere. And he said, I couldn't tell them that. He said, oh, he said, I fabricated a story. Yes, I did know him. I did know he was killed, and I do know he didn't suffer, which he certainly didn't. But it was a tragic thing to have happened.
So you didn't get called back for Arnhem in any way,
no.
But were you, well, obviously, well, after Arnhem, the troops well, really stayed there for the winter, didn't they, before?
Oh, yes. What happened with us is we were returned to Bulford and the normal training routine. And then one morning I was in the brigade headquarters where our signal office was located. And this must have been probably 6 days or so before Christmas, 1944. And a Major General walked into the headquarters and went into Brigadier Poet's office. And this was on the Wednesday morning. Christmas Eve was on the Friday that week, and we were all getting ready to go home. On Friday, we entrained and went to Folkestone, and we sailed at about 11 o'clock at night from Folkestone on an old cross-channel steamer called the Princess Maud, and we were sent out to the Battle of the Bulge, as it was called then, or later by the media. In the middle of the night, we felt this old ship. She was shaking and vibrating. And we woke up on Christmas morning, and we were anchored a mile off Margate. And apparently we'd been chased back by E-boats during the night. And Christmas Day, we had, as the French would call it, un bon repas. We had bully beef, jam and biscuits for breakfast, and they weren't biscuits as we know them now. Cheese and biscuits for lunch, and bully beef and biscuits for dinner. We eventually had our Christmas dinner sometime in February, and we went out to the Ardennes, and we were moving up.
The weather at that time was very bad, wasn't it?
Oh, it was bitterly cold, thick fog, and it was bitterly cold. We were moving up through this fog, and then just suddenly out of a gap in the fog, a Messerschmitt 109 swept in and machine gunned the column as he went over diagonally. And we were always seemed to be unfortunate with our second in command, because our lieutenant, who'd replaced Gordon Royal, was a Lieutenant Taffy Jenkins, very good lad. One of the cannon shells ricocheted off the road through the front bumper of the truck in which he was riding and up through the floor into his foot. So we lost our second command that time. And then we were then around Namur, and I was still with the same Lance Corporal and Bert Shea, my pal, and we were then doing what was called intercept radio. If the brigade headquarters was out of touch with the battalion, we would have to go out with our set halfway and relay messages. That was all right, but sitting in a freezing jeep, which is completely open, the temperature being somewhere down to 0 degrees Fahrenheit, was no great joke. I remember one night we had to be lifted out of the jeep. We pulled up, we found, saw a light, and it happened to be a Royal Artillery officer's mess, and they came out and they helped us in and warmed us up, and gave us some very nice hot toddy, if I can remember. We were on this little farm where the farmer's name was Hanoul, H-A-N-O-U-L, and the farm was called Ferme du Bois Givet. It was sort of up in the trees, and we were relaying, and then one evening the kitchen door burst open, and a patrol of the Maquis, the French resistance, came in. And luckily for us and the family, they had been informed that there was a German Wallace operating at this farm. And when they got to the door, they could hear the voices and they could hear the female voices. And so they decided not to burst in and shoot, but to burst in and see what was what, which was rather fortunate. There was one young lady on this farm, and her name was Adele Anul, and she was very pretty. And I can remember at the time being quite taken, but we quickly moved on, and that was the end of that.
So was it just the... Were you all sent... just the signal part of your battalion sent, or the actual Paris, the whole lot went?
The whole division.
Yeah.
The whole division.
So there was no question of them dropping in or anything?
No.
They'd gone overland, yeah.
We were sent out. This would be, as I say, we actually landed on Boxing Night, and our job was to bolster up. The bulge had already been arrested, but still more troops were needed, and we were there for, I should think, into probably late January. I'm not quite clear of dates. And then we went to a rest area on the banks of the River Marse, north of the Mail, and from there we were resting. And the Germans were likewise resting on the other bank of the Marse, and it was a little bit of, if you don't tickle me, I won't tickle you. Then we came back home to again re-equip and ready for the next operation, which was the Rhine crossing. So we were brought home to England, back to our own camp, our own billets in Bulford camp, and re-equipped and got ready for the next operation. We were briefed for this, and it was the Rhine crossing. The plan was that this was a daylight drop on a Sunday morning, as I remember. It was a brilliant, fine morning. Anyway, we were driven to this airfield during the night.
This was about March, wasn't it?
Yes, 45. March the 25th, 1945. And there were these American Dakotas lined up. So we assembled, and eventually we were slightly resorted because there were too much load on some of the planes. And eventually then... early in the morning, the American air crews arrived. So we said to them, we knew they'd come from Brussels. So we said to them, where are we? They said, shucks, I don't know. So we said, well, how the hell did you get here? Well, so we followed the guy in front. So what does he do? He follows the guy in front. What does he do? Well, he follows the colonel. The colonel knows where we're going. If we get lost, we just come down, find an airfield and say, where the hell are we? So, we set off for the Rhine crossing. And our aircraft was crewed by an American Transport Command crew who were tour expired. Their kit was packed, ready to fly straight home to America. But they were asked to do this one extra trip. All went well. We flew in this huge formation with hundreds of Spitfires and Hurricanes roaming round, keeping us safe. As we crossed the Rhine, you could see the smoke, and then you could see burning Dakotas flying back underneath you. And then over the dropping zone, and we were then getting very heavily hit by anti-aircraft. And we ploughed on. When you jump, there are two signals. There are two lights. A red light, which is warning, and that switches to green and you jump. The other signal is the alarm bell. That means get out quick. So we flew on. an our aircraft was badly hit in the starboard wing. The engine was on fire, and we were still getting heavily hit. The pilot would not let us jump, and as soon as we came out of the flak belt, he gave us the alarm bell, which is get out. So luckily I was number two. I pushed number one out, who was one of our signalmen, Owen Simpson. He came from the north end of Morecambe Bay, as I remember. So I pushed Owen out and fell out after him. And by the time it took me to get down, I would estimate that we probably jumped at about 500 feet or less, and the aircraft was coming down. There were 10 of us got away safely. We found number 11 dead on the ground, and two Dakotas, both burning in the starboard wing, crashed very close. One of those was our plane. So we gradually made our way back. And
so the rest of the people?
Yes, because we were
in the plane.
We were 5 or 6 miles beyond.
Yeah.
We were in the Reichwald Forest. And walking back, we came across a group of medics who asked us, could we pick up a walking wounded? They would stay with the seriously wounded and be captured, but the Germans would look after the wounded. So the chap I picked up was a pilot of an RAF Typhoon, and he had been shot down, and I understand from reading that it was the only Typhoon shot down that morning, and the pilot was, from memory, a Flight Lieutenant Trafford. I've never contacted him. I often wish I had, but I'd like to, but there it is. So I helped him back, and we came across this farm in a huge clearing in the forest. It was probably 800 acres with a farm in the middle. So I dropped this wounded pilot off there to be treated, and as I came round the back of the farmhouse, there was a sudden and a line of machine gun bullets from an MG-34 just zipped across the ground in front of my toes. That was as near as I'd ever likely to be that morning. And I understood later that the patrol was sent out to pick up this German machine gunner without, if possible, harming him, because he had obeyed the Geneva Convention in that he did not shoot at anybody helping wounded in, but we were fair game on the other side. So I made my way back and eventually joined. We were probably 6 or 7 miles inland. And made our way back to the section. And then from there, it was a more or less headlong gallop, with the objective, as we understood later, of trying to cut the Russians off. We eventually met the Russians at Wismar on the Baltic coast, and we were only there till not long after VE Day, when we were flown back from Lüneburg airfield back to England.
So I'll stop you there, because it'd be interesting to elaborate a bit on that, because not many people have met the Russians. The planes, obviously, the pilots were all killed on that last mission.
I assume so, yes.
And several of your colleagues as well.
Our aircraft, from memory, had 15 or 16 of us in. As I say, we found number 11 dead on the ground, so 10 of us got away okay. The others were our own wonderful airborne military police. It was a very, very sad day. They were great chaps, and they were all killed.
And you crossed the Rhine, obviously, and moved on. Did you get much opposition from the Germans, or had they just retreated?
Well, as I say, we got into the flak belt, and our aircraft was hit as it was leading a formation of 27 and set on fire. And of course, that was a target then. Yeah. And eventually she went down. But, as I say, that the 10 of us got away. We were very, very lucky.
So you walked to rejoin the rest of your people?